hello, punk fans. Welcome to this week's Punk News Podcast. I am Brian Yancey, your quote-unquote host, but not really. This is a special episode of the show in that it's our 150th episode. And as such, we're gonna basically do a regular show, but we've got a couple of treats in store. One of them you may have just heard. The other is that we got the old band back together, if you will. The original lineup of the Punk News Podcast is here to entertain you, most likely bore you. We'll just have to see how it goes. We'll have to see if we can just if we can recreate the magic, as it were. But I'm here with Adam White. Hello, Adam.
Hey, and bore you is probably what we're going to do.
Yes. And making his triumphant return, the dulcet tones of Rich Verducci. Hello, Rich.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming back. It's wonderful to hear your voice.
Thank you. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'll take it.
It's straight from the heart, man. Straight from the heart.
People miss you when we all sound like wieners, and you sound you sound like a man, and that's what people want.
People need the deep masculinity, the reassuring tones on their podcast.
It's like Rich and a bunch of 8-year olds. It's kind of how
they
show it.
It's very soothing in a way.
Well, that's good. I've been working on my mature tones lately, so hopefully I can add a little bit of brevity, or not brevity, I guess, but seriousness to our conversations.
I don't see that happening.
Not brevity, the opposite of brevity.
The opposite of anything good.
Yeah.
So I'll add that. But thank you.
Cool. So we've got a bunch of stuff to get to, including obviously the most important punknews.org stories from the last week. But first, I'm going to play a song for you. This is from a band called Sugar Stems. They're from Milwaukee. They're on Dirt Nap Records. But they're not a prototypical Dirt Nap band in that they don't really sound like the Marked Men at all. They play a more kind of lighter, more power pop, almost folky at times style, with female vocals, male vocals as well. And it's actually really great. Their album is called Can't Wait. It came out in April. It's on Bandcamp for like $7. Highly recommend you pick it up. If you like any sort of like power pop or like 60s girls groups or even like Nico Case, you would probably dig this. And this is my favorite song from the record. It's called Magic Act. And again, the name of the band is Sugar Stems.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back to the Punk News Podcast, episode number 150. Once again, I'm Brian, and I'm here with Rich and Adam. Original lineup, pretty exciting. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the 20th anniversary of Bad Religion's Recipe for Hate, which we posted a story about, but Stereo Gum did a very nice job sort of talking about, you know, the record, its release, what kind of, like what the music scene was like at the time. Obviously, it was very different then from what it was now, because alternative music, thanks to Nirvana and kind of the grunge revival, was getting a lot of recognition and in the mainstream. I mean, you couldn't, if you were an alternative rock band in 1993 or 1994, chances are you were either on a major label or you were offered a major label contract. So the Stereo Gum piece is really in-depth. It talks about, you know, the circumstances surrounding the release being that it was Bad Religion's major label debut, and, you know, they have all these kind of weird songs on it, and it's a little, like, it sounds like a Bad Religion record, but then there's kind of this, like, Eddie Vedder's on a song, and then there's this, these other, like, weird things that the band had never really done before. So highly recommend you check that out. I believe all three of us listened to the record again tonight to kind of refresh our memories, and I think it holds up pretty well. The bad songs on it are still not that good, but more or less, I think it's more than deserving of the praise that it got in this piece, and I'm curious to hear what y'all think about it.
This is a weird ass record in retrospect. It's
I guess it's
notable for circumstance and kind of like when it came out and like its place in that arc of what was going on in alternative music, and that's okay. But it's really uneven. Like there's like the bad songs on this record are bad. I mean, and I mean, Rich, you were talking about this on Facebook earlier, but like All Good Soldiers is a bad song.
Yeah.
And there's a few other things on there that I just that just do not work for me at all. So, you know, it's not a great record that I think we're celebrating 20 years on because it was some sort of watershed. It's more that it was for a lot of people an important record. It was a timely record, I guess, but great's yeah. Probably not the right word. I mean, there are great songs on it. Like American Jesus is a badass song. You know, there's things on here that to me hold up really well. Actually, the video for American Jesus is fucking awesome. I've always liked that video. But you know, there's just stuff on here that is to me just bizarre in retrospect. Like first of all, the Eddie Vedder thing. If I had not read that when doing my research for this afterwards, I totally have never known that was him on that song. Nor did I really even clue in that there was another vocalist singing that second verse. It's almost like unless I'm listening to some weird copy of this that he's not on there, it sounds like Eddie Vedder doing a Greg Graffin impression. So that's kind of weird. And then the other thing is Struck a Nerve, which is a song that I actually quite like. The and I forget her name, from Concrete Blonde, who guests on it, I think is weird. It sounds weird. It's like, to me, she's not really in the song, but then all of a sudden, like at the very end, Jeanette DiPolitano, there we go. At the very end of the song, she's like, Struck a Nerve! In the middle of the chorus, and I'm just like, what the hell? I'm like, well, like all of a sudden it's hair metal and I don't understand. So I don't know. Yeah, there's weird stuff that is on this thing for sure. I mean, I don't know. I'm using up too much air here. Rich.
I think before Rich chimes in, I think what's interesting about this to me is that like you said, kind of how the landscape was so different back then, and that based on how weird and how uneven this record is for a major label debut, even for a band like Bad Religion, who, you know, this is what, their seventh full length. So they had six albums of material before this that people could draw from. I think it's interesting that, you know, like if they had come along a generation later, say now, and that record had been their major label debut, they probably would have been dropped immediately, you know, following its release. Instead, you know, the landscape was a lot different back then. And as a result, they kind of, you know, they stayed on Atlantic for, you know, pretty much all of the 90s after that. And That part I find really interesting because that's definitely not the case now. Labels don't really let bands take chances like that. And if they do take chances and they fail, they try to get out of the relationship as quickly as possible. But Rich, go ahead.
It is. I'm kind of looking at things really quick just to kind of read up on it. Because the thing that I thought I was wrong about this, but I'm not, is that it was the last one that they did sort of with Epitaph. So it was originally like it was done by Atlantic, but I think like originally it was supposed to be with Epitaph, and then yeah, I don't know, some things. So like I don't understand quite why it's so weird. I don't know if it was like on their own that they determined they wanted to make a different record, or because it doesn't seem, and it may be the major label thing, but for me, it, like, my thought is I thought that they were doing it on their own and then later they decided to push for Atlantic. So the whole, I don't necessarily see it maybe as a major label push, but I definitely know, I mean, Brett Gurewitz like left Bad Religion during that time period, if I remember correctly, because he admitted to having a very deep and dependent drug issue, and that would certainly explain some of what is seen on this album, because if you run down the tracks, like, you know, who wrote what, the ones that are primarily Gurewitz heavy are the really weird sort of like ones that I don't understand. Like, you know, he did All Good Soldiers. He did, you know, Modern Day Catastrophe. Oh no, that's Graffin actually.
Yeah.
But the point is,
of course it is. It has the word catastrophist in it.
Thank you. I'm not good with reading at the moment, but yeah, so I mean that to me would be part of it, but it's a really weird album, and it's weird for me personally because I mean it was one of the first, it has some of the first Bad Religion songs I was ever really exposed to. American Jesus, Kerosene for Better or Worse, Struck a Nerve, like those were all, like, I had a friend who had a tape deck and those were all songs that he played on that tape deck. Like, it was a weird tape of like all different songs. So it was some of the first Bad Religion that I really listened to, and it has a special place for me. But as an album, it is not a good album. Like, if it came out, like, if they put this album out today, it would be sort of a 6 or 7 out of 10 album. It's just kind of, like, iffy at best. But there are really good songs about it, and it is, you know, it was a really popular album. You know, it exposed a lot of people. I mean, a lot of their Atlantic releases really did. I mean, this and Stranger Than Fiction, you know, were both really, really popular. And so I understand, you know, the significance of it. And I understand, like, I don't know. I like the weird, like, sort of strange shortcomings in a band's catalog, because it's easy to sit there and kind of like, especially a band like Bad Religion, who has a lot of really quality releases, it's easy to sit there and talk about what your favorite album is, because there's a couple of albums that pretty much everybody agrees are almost perfect in their catalog. If you're a Bad Religion fan, there's always stuff that no one, you know, someone's going to be like, I hate all their stuff because I don't like Sunshine and Puppies, and I'm going to sit in my room and eat kale and listen to Bjork, and that's, like, great for you. But, you know, there's a couple of Bad Religions that everybody likes, but the weird albums, the albums that didn't do so good, like, for me, some of those have some really great tracks on them, and they're more fun to listen to in some way because it is a little bit more of a transition for a band. Like, honestly, you know, I'm not going to say I enjoy The Gray Race. I don't. It's not a very good album. But I like listening to it and kind of, like, just, like, trying to figure out what they thought was a great idea in that album, you know? And I like listening to the weird little strange parts because it gives you a little better view of the band's history. You can listen to a greatest hits album and you can listen to the best of albums all the time, but it just gives you kind of like, these are the great songs that they wrote. Like, some of the bad songs that they wrote that they don't necessarily really play a lot or that don't get a lot of attention are kind of, you know, sometimes the more interesting ones. Like, for as much as I will bag on All Good Soldiers because it's a horrible song, if you listen to that, like, next to songs like Generator or next to songs like Against the Grain that are really great Bad Religion songs, you kind of sit there and you're just, what made them think to do this? Where did they sit down and go, this is what we're going to do now? Because it doesn't add up with the rest of their catalog, and so it's a little more fun to listen to. I wouldn't want to do it every day, But, you know, for a little experiment, it's fun to sit down and listen to these albums. So,
I mean, yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the reasons why I actually really like The New America, because it totally doesn't sound like you'd expect it to be. And it's partially probably because, like, Todd Rundgren produced it, which is sort of a weird combination. And you get songs in there like It's a Long Way to the Promised Land that is, you know, totally not a Bad Religion song. It's a good song. I actually like that song a lot, but it's not a Bad Religion song. And it's weird to hear them do something that's more of like a straight, almost, I don't even know what you would call that, like a pop indie rock kind of thing with, you know, big soaring, you know, harmonies. It's not aggressive in the way that you know, you the stuff that you'd hear on a Greatest album would be. Now, but again, there are depths of crap that you get to when you start walking down this road. I mean, if we're talking about, say, New America, you know, you have I Love My Computer on there, right? So
No. I love that song, and because it's a perfect representation of how people understood, like, the internet in 2000.
Yeah,
it's such
okay.
a perfect 13-year-old song. It's so great.
Aged well, right?
No, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I suppose, and I get that was the point, but it just, like, with every passing year, it becomes more cringe-inducing.
No, it absolutely is, but I love, like, I think the first time that I heard it even was, like, in 2005, because I didn't follow Bad Religion that much because I was too cool at the time, and I heard it, and I was just like, even 5 years later, that song had aged. Like, you listen to it, and you're just like, this sounds like my grandfather talking about the internet. And so now, 8 years on from that, at 13 years, I, like, it's a comical song. It's like a Lonely Island song at this point. It's so just ridiculous and aged, you know? But, no, it's not a good song, but it's great to listen to.
But, I mean, back to Recipe, there are lyrics on this record that I really like, particularly in that, for something that was, I guess potentially something that had a bit of, like, a mainstream breakthrough motivation to it. And I don't know if that's true or not, but because of what you said about how they were on Epitaph and they moved it to Atlantic. But there's a lot of, like, really crazy Graffin lingo on this. There's some big Graffin vocabulary that normally, you know, gets buried into, like, a faster song that it's not really, you don't really notice it unless you're looking at the lyrics for it, but on here it always shows up on some of the ballads, and it sticks out in a way that, well, it sticks out, but you kind of get the impression that they were aware that it stuck out and they kind of kept it in there, where they knew that they had that reputation at the time when they were recording it. And they're like, we need a few more big words for this song. just to tweak people. Right.
Yeah.
So I get that from a few of the slower songs on this record. And not, I don't know, not that they're insincere, just that they're self-aware. And I find it kind of enjoyable.
Yeah. I feel like Recipe for Hate was kind of the slow beginnings of Greg Graffin sort of kind of, realizing that he didn't have to necessarily dial it in as much as he would have to, as much as he had in the past, or, you know, he was kind of going off on his own thing. And like Rich pointed out, this was kind of like during the time that Brett Gerwitz was having his personal issues. And he actually, you know, he stayed on. He played on Stranger Than Fiction, which was the album after this. But after that, he left. And then after Brett left, as we all know, the band kind of, well, Greg Graffin took over pretty much all the songwriting, and from there, there was kind of nobody to tell him no, that something was a bad idea. He was kind of the George Lucas of punk rock, like No Substance was their Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. Yeah, it's interesting in that respect, and
to this day, I don't think that I have heard No Substance.
I've heard enough of it to know that I don't like it.
Like it had been so driven into my head when I was, the 90s punk kid, that No Substance was Radioactive and you shouldn't go near there. And this band has lots of stuff that's good, but don't go near No Substance. It's evil. And I don't think I ever have.
I would say there are a couple of pretty good songs on it, but for the most part, it's forgettable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if there's anything they'd play off it live.
Oh, no, not even close.
Yeah. Does anyone know? Because again, this will be similar to that. Was the number on the CD? Did that mean anything on the front? The 1-800? Could you call that?
I have no idea. It was a little before my time, unfortunately. I didn't have a cell phone in 1993.
No. The number on the cover of No Substance. So it's like what, 98, 99?
It was 98. But, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was like 96. But I didn't have one then either. For that matter. Yeah.
Fair enough. Hmm. We should all call it now. That's what I like about Bad Religion is they have a great arc in the music that they've done, because they've done some really good music and they've done some really terrible music and they've done some back and forth and it's been cool. Whereas like not to be that guy, but bands like Pennywise have just always sort of consistently. I couldn't tell you, with the possible exception of the last one they did with Zoli, because I thought that was kind of a shit deal. I don't think they've ever made, like, a really bad album, but, like, they've stopped making really interesting albums. And I feel like Bad Religion, you know, for as long as they've been around, have always, like, tried to make interesting music at the very least. And that's, I mean, witnessed by the several very bad albums that they made. So.
Yeah, and like you said, in a way, like, for a band with such a huge catalog, like, sometimes the failures are more interesting to listen to in retrospect than the successes.
Oh, yeah.
For, you know, a lot of reasons. So, and there are parts of Recipe for Hate that certainly fall under that umbrella.
Oh, no. Yeah, there are some, there's definitely some very good songs on that album.
Yeah. Speaking of old punk bands, it looks like that Filmage, The Story of Descendants All, is going to finally come out this month. In fact, it's going to be premiered at the North by Northeast Film Festival in Toronto on June 15th, which is in a couple of days. So there's a new trailer that surfaced. We've got that up on Hawk News.
Sorry.
And Nariman just rode off on his motorcycle. So you should check out this trailer. It's got a bunch of huge names kind of extolling the virtues of the Descendants. I mean, Mark Hoppus is in it, Dave Grohl, you know, members of the Descendants and all, obviously. And it looks really well done, and it looks like it's going to be worth the wait. And I'm not even sure how long this has been in the works. I feel like it's been several years, but I can't wait to see this. Like, it looks awesome. So, how do you guys feel about the trailer?
I'm pretty excited. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of bands who get, like, documentaries just on basis of popularity or whatever, like, and the Descendants and all, I think, are just, I think they got a really good story, and I think they're a fantastic band, and they've been around in most capacities for years and years, and, like, who was it in the trailer? I think, I want to say it was, like, Dave Grohl, who said, basically, you have all these bands who were writing, like, very angry songs about Reagan, and the Descendants, you know, they had the guts to write, essentially, what is a love song, and... Yeah. You know, just how different and how brave that was. And it really, you know, you don't think about it now because of all the bands they've influenced since then who, you know, are willing to take that sound that it seems the norm. But at the time, it really was, you know, it was something different and it was something exciting. And, you know, if there's a band that, you know, deserves a some sort of, you know, biography about them, it's the Descendants. If this and probably the long-delayed... Jawbreaker documentary are the two like I'm unbelievably excited for, and kind of also didn't think they would happen. So this is all good things.
Yeah, I think that this has the potential to just be really, really interesting, just because the Descendants are there's so much about them that has sort of become part of, I don't know, like the iconography of modern punk, just like looking at it from just like the art sensibilities that they had, the, you know, the look of Descendants stuff, the, you know, the not just the cartoon character of Milo and all that, but just there was a certain look and feel that stayed really consistent, I think, with a lot of stuff the Descendants released. I mean, to a lesser degree All when they were around, but that still feels very pure, I think. There was no
absolutely
like they didn't have some moment where they stopped doing stuff that engaged people and decided to make like a political record about George Bush Sr. or something like that, right? like they didn't have that self-aware point where they stopped what they were doing and said, okay, now we have to change with the times. Now, I granted they have the opportunity in their latter years of releasing something every, you know, million years. So, you know, they didn't necessarily get caught up in the by the moment stuff. But there was a lot about them, I think, that they didn't fuck up is what I'm going with. Where a lot of people will can take, you know, you could take the whole Descendants catalog, you know, warts and all, and, you know, bands from that we listened to when we were kids and bands that are coming up now are able to kind of take that stuff and just template off of it, kind of, and, you know, this is the kind of band we want to aspire to be. And I think that's, you don't have a lot of bands that do that. I remember like when I was like a 90s ska kid, I said I was a 90s punk kid earlier, but I guess I was a 90s ska kid. When I was a 90s ska kid, I mean, I learned about the Descendants from Vinny from Less Than Jake, because in any interview that he did, you know, he was extolling the virtues of Descendants. And that was, it was this kind of like undercurrent in all the bands that I was listening to. They had this common denominator where they were saying, you know, oh yeah, we were influenced by XYZ and the Descendants, of course.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's something really appealing about that. I'm rambling, but that's.
No, that's I'm going. Yeah, I totally agree. It's interesting that you know, like Rich said, you know, it seems like a lot of those bands, and it's like Dave Grohl said in the trailer that all those bands in the 80s were kind of just writing songs about Reagan and being pissed at the president, which was relevant at the time and very much of the time. But in a certain respect, and I'm not 100% sure that they did this on purpose, but the way the Descendants wrote their songs, they ended up being far more timeless than any song about Reagan could have been. So I think in that respect, you know, it's pretty cool. And they were the first punk band to really do that. And I feel like this documentary is going to be great, but I'm going to pretend this show is live because I have breaking news. The Replacements are going to be reuniting for Riot Fest in Chicago, Toronto, and Denver. That just came over the wire.
What?
Their first live show since 1991.
Wow. Did they get everybody, or is it because I know they didn't get everyone for the EP they were doing? They didn't get
The press release doesn't say. So I'm gonna assume that it's Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson and a couple of hired guns.
That's all right.
But yeah, there you go. I'm sure we'll have a story on Punk News before this podcast goes live. But boom, breaking news!
Huh.
It's like on the radio.
That is like I feel like we just got interrupted by like a speech from the president. But it's about the Replacements, which is kind of better.
Oh, I really have to go to Riot Fest now.
Where's Riot Fest?
Chicago, one in Toronto.
Chicago, Toronto, and Denver this year are the Riot Fest sites.
There need to be better fests on the West Coast. We have a couple, but not anything like that.
You have like the Gathering?
Yeah, the Gathering is in Detroit. First,
oh, I don't know. I assume this shit's in California.
Yo, Adam, the Gathering's like 4 hours away from where you
are. Yeah, that's actually really close to me. Huh.
Well, I guess we know what you're doing next year. Live feature on Adam White at the Gathering, the Juggalos.
I can take my daughter.
Oh, my God. She'd love it. There's a bunch of clowns. Everyone's painting faces. You're camping. It's a perfect family experience. Though, I will say, they played here recently, and a super jaded Oakland reporter for a local magazine went and said that it actually restored her faith in music. Like, she went expecting to make fun of everything, and she was just like, everybody there was so enthralled and so excited and just so genuinely happy to be there. She's like, in between sets, nobody was on their phone, nobody was like texting, everybody was talking and having a good time. And she was like, as terrible as the music is, she's like, it kind of restored my faith in music. So there you go. That was some positive reinforcement.
Shit. Okay. everyone shut up for a second. Okay. They actually just released the Riot Fest lineups for, well, for, I don't know, for Toronto's the one that I'm looking at here.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. this is hilarious to me because I'm going to compare you the Saturday and the Sunday, okay? So this is the Saturday at Riot Fest Toronto. A Day to Remember, Pierce the Veil, Every Time I Die, Mayday Parade, Grade, The Ghost Inside, Structures, and Real Friends. Okay?
So I'm so there.
So that's Saturday. This is Sunday. The Replacements, Iggy and the Stooges, The Weaker Thans, Rocket from the Crypt, Dinosaur Jr., Best Coast, The Flatliners, and Single Mothers.
Wow.
Yeah, that day is a little stacked.
They're not trying to change anybody's mind, are they?
Wow. I have no reason to go to that Saturday at all.
No.
But, holy shit.
Very cool. I was already planning on going to the Chicago date. Now I'm even more excited.
The Chicago date also features Sublime with Rome.
And Fall Out Boy, don't forget. And Blink-182, for that matter.
And I'm looking at the poster. I'm assuming the question marks came out to be the Replacements.
It's got to be.
That would be my guess.
I mean, who else are they going to get that's going to be bigger than that? You know,
I don't know. They already have Fall Out Boy and Blink-182, so those spots are taken.
What do you think is Pete Wentz's favorite Replacement song? How many Replacement songs do you think he can name?
I guarantee you he can name like Bastards of Young. Like he knows a couple. He has like one or two on his iPod that he can keep, you know, to call out if he needs to.
It's not a punk news podcast unless we call Pete Wentz a poser somehow.
I do. I have a checklist every day and it's on there, so I can mark that off today. Screeching Weasel too, pretty stoked on that.
Can we talk about Screeching Weasel on the
show today? I had to work it in there. Any chance. Sorry.
Alright. So that was a pretty long segment. I feel like we should take a break now. If you guys are cool with that, and do a song.
Sure.
Okay, cool. Richard?
Oh, is it my song?
It is.
All right, excellent. So, I've despite dropping Lonely Island earlier, I'm not really big into gimmick bands and jokes and, like, joke songs. They don't work well for me, which is weird because the track that I have this week is from a local Bay Area band called Arno Core, who Soundguy Nerman is familiar with as well. They're a... no other way to put it than an Arnold Schwarzenegger-themed hardcore band. A lot of their songs are based off of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. They have... the lead singer does a very fantastic Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation. And it sounds horrible. It sounds like it would be an awful, terrible idea, but it's not, and it's fantastic, and it works really well. And the basis of that is that all of the songs that they do are actually really well done. It's not just... like, they write songs and they craft them around these movies. They don't just sort of ham-fistedly make a joke about Predator and then that's the song. It's phenomenally well done and it's really fun. And they have two guitar players, a drummer, and two bassists and a singer. So it's six guys making this music and it sounds awesome. They actually just released their new EP, the Fantastic EP, which they self-funded through Kickstarter. So if you guys get the opportunity to see them... live, they don't tour much, but they're amazing. I've seen them with Soundguy and Airman before, and one time I saw them, the cops got called. One time I saw them and got kicked in the face by the drummer. It's pretty much always an exciting show. So anyhow, this is Arno Core with Exactly off of the Fantastic EP. Enjoy.
Dinosaur, building dogs. making of the sword, with the making of the character. Cause the stronger it will get, right? The stronger the steel will get with all that. And the same is with the character. The more resistance that you give it, the more obstacles it can overcome.
Back to the Punk News Podcast Roundtable once again. I'm Brian. I'm here with Adam and Rich. We got a couple more stories to throw at you real quick. The first one is SFH, which stands for Shit From Hell, by the way, in case you were wondering. They released a video for their song Mare on Crack, which is a rather overt reference to Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, who has been accused of smoking crack with drug dealers on camera. And as far as I know, is generally fairly unliked in the city where he is mayor. So you can check out the video on Punk News. It's kind of a dumb video. It's kind of a dumb song, but you know, it's topical. And there's some really bad CGI in the video that looks like it was done by like a freshman graphic design intern.
I think I know a lot of background on this, so I'm just going to interject.
I can't wait to hear it. Go right ahead.
I'm pretty sure that the bad CGI is from there's this weird, like, I don't know, South Korean news source that takes like things that are in the news and makes these bizarre video gamey graphics videos of it. So that's I think lifted right out of their YouTube story on that they did on the Rob Ford thing. And like I'm pretty sure like those videos are just like completely gonzo things happen, like stuff that has nothing to do with the story at all, but they decide would be funny, they put into these videos, and it's weird. I don't understand. But The really important thing here is, because I want to talk about Shit From Hell, because there is this incredibly, I think, unlike anything else in punk rock connection that exists in this band. And the singer for the band, Warren Kinsella, he's the guy in the video that kind of looks like Bill Murray. And if you ever hear him talk, he kind of sounds like Bill Murray too, which is kind of cool. Warren is one of the top political war room strategists in Canada. So he used to be like back in the 70s, he was a member of a 70s punk band called the Hot Nasties out of Calgary. But in the, you know, ensuing years, he became a lawyer, and then he became a political strategist. I'm probably really butchering his bio, and I'm sorry, because I'm going to tell him that we're on here. But he was basically the guy that ran the war room for our prime minister of the three terms in the 90s, Jean Chrétien, for Dalton McGuinty, who was the premier of Ontario for a few years. So he was one of the most successful political strategist guys in Canada. It is as if James Carville had a punk band. He has been called, I've seen quotes where they have referred to him as like Canada's James Carville. Like he's that kind of larger than life, not Cajun, of course, but where he has this like huge personality, and that now that he is not the political strategist behind the scenes anymore, he's, you know, all over the news, being a commentator and stuff like that. So he's kind of like person least likely to have an active punk band, let alone to have been in a 70s punk band. So I don't know. I find him a fascinating guy. And yeah, so anyways, that's who Kinsella is. So I don't want to talk about Rob Ford. Just talk about Rob Ford.
We don't have to if you don't want to.
No, I don't.
If it's a sore subject. I mean, it's interesting because here in America we deal with so much like political bullshit and corruption from our politicians that it's almost a breath of fresh air in a sinister way to see somebody in Canada where everybody's just so nice and everybody gets along great, to see this fucking batshit insane guy, you know, in charge of, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world, more or less.
Yeah. And Toronto has had its share of really crazy flamboyant mayors in the past, but they've had well, one in particular that, you know, will only be relevant to Canadians, that, you know, put his foot in his mouth all the time and, you know, created all sorts of, you know, international embarrassments from time to time, but nothing like this. Like this, yeah. Is and just every day there's something new in this story that comes up. So it's like become basically our like morning routine. Is like we get to the office in the morning, we find out what the next crazy twist in the Rob Ford thing is, because it's not going away. It keeps getting weird up here. And I mean, I assume that the coverage at some point in the States will have, you know, backed off on it. But especially like after Gawker wasn't able to raise the video, or wasn't able to actually get the video after they raised all that money. Right. So I assume that maybe it died down a bit here. But like people here are, they're just, you know, it seems like every day some member of his cabinet quits. And that's always big news here. Or, you know, they'll talk to someone that worked on his campaign last time and they're like, I'm not going to work on his campaign until he gets help. Or they're, you know, or
stop smoking crack.
Or they'll analyze that one photo of him and they'll realize that, like, oh, the house that's in the background is this house, and then they actually identify where it is in Toronto, and then they're like, and then they go and they're like, they'll look up the house and the house has like a drug history and stuff like that, like just like it keeps getting worse. So
that's amazing.
Not to revel in someone's downfall, I mean there's a good degree of like Ben Weasel word schadenfreude here, because Ford is a big loud conservative blowhard that happens to be in charge of, at least when you look at the downtown, a, you know, very liberal progressive city. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of people that are sort of, you know, sitting back and watching this with a big tub of popcorn because, you know, they want to see him fail. And you know, it's just, yeah, it's just, I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just, it's not going away. It keeps getting more and more of a thing here, and we're just kind of waiting for the shoe to drop, where either something's going to come out or there's going to be some blow up, or the poor guy is going to have like a big public heart attack or something, right? So we're waiting for where this is going, because it keeps going. It's kind of like it's been like the major news story up here for the past month, at least. Like, you know, every once in a while, actual news from around the world gets in the way of it. But then we inevitably go back to Rob Ford. So
go back to Rob Ford smoking crack.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know at what point we're supposed to tire of this story up here. But it's just every time it seems like it's losing steam, it takes another weird turn. So, yeah, it keeps going. It is a thing. We'll put it on our money one day, I'm sure.
Oh, I hope so. I want to use that photo that they use in the story where he's like dabbing his forehead with his like little towel. That should be like on whatever bill Rob Ford is on. I would buy that money. But when you're that size, smoking crack cocaine just seems dangerous. Like, because of the heart, the circulatory issues, like, I just feel like you're gambling at that point. And I wouldn't recommend that. Also, I always think it's funny when people actually do smoke crack, because crack is like the joke, right? You know, like everybody now is like, oh, I was sweating all day at work because I was working really hard. It was like I was on crack, and everyone's like, haha, good one. So that like no one really remembers people actually smoke crack. Like people actually really do crack. And so I don't know, like when it was discovered, not that she's dead now, it's kind of horrible, but when like everyone was like, Whitney Houston actually smoked crack, I was like, that's crazy. People actually really smoke crack. And so it's kind of fantastic that this guy is a mayor, and it's like, that's crazy, he actually smokes crack. Like, he couldn't get, like, Oxycontin or codeine or, like, I don't know, whatever rich white people do, but, like, crack. Like, it just doesn't seem like a drug people actually really do. It just seems like a joke most of the time.
I mean, at the very least, not someone who's, like, the head of a major city. You figure that they would have some sort of, you know, higher society drug than crack out of a pipe.
But this is the thing. Do you think he, like, worked his way to crack? Or, like, one day he just had a, like, really long day. He's like, fuck it. Drive me down. Drive me into the Lower East Side or wherever it is in Toronto. I'm going to go smoke some crack. Like, do you think he was just like, he was like, I'm going to do this now? Or do you think, like, he started out with pills and then he ran out of pills? And then he didn't know how to get more, and his doctor, you know, he was in Canada, so he couldn't see a doctor for, like, 4 years, because that's what I learned from Obamacare, is you can't see doctors anymore when you have socialized medicine. So he was like, I need to do something, and, like, one of his aides was like, Rob, have you tried crack? And he was, yes!
As I understand it, I kind of have two answers to this. I think the realistic one, and what seems to be coming out in the news here, are... No, again, there's been no confirmation of this at all, aside from the fact that reporters reported seeing the video. There's been no, you know, the rest of us haven't seen the video, so there's no proof to this that's out there. So it's also speculation. But what seems to be coming out is the house that's been identified of – that's been in the photo that the reporters were given, that they do have, that was that was kind of given by the same drug dealers that were shopping around the video. Turns out to be, you know, the family that lives in that house has a long time connection to the Ford family. And there's a long time drug, you know, reputation that that house has and stuff like that. So, I mean, it seems like it's that if this is true, it's not something that's probably recent. It's probably something that has, you know, that is predicated on some established relationship that he had with these people. So who knows? My better answer to this is I kind of think that Rob Ford is sort of like the Juggernaut, or where he's just this big, loud, angry freight train of a dude, and some fucking crack's not going to sway him. He can just breeze through that shit. He's probably drinking gasoline, right? So that's the real answer that I have to this, is that he's the Juggernaut.
After you murder a hooker, man, everything else just seems like small potatoes, probably, so he's okay with that. I'm just assuming he's probably murdered a hooker. I can't, you know, I can't say he has, but he probably has murdered a hooker. Theoretically. Jesus. If I was a betting man.
I cannot speak to this.
Odds are
2-1. All right. So with that in mind, let's wrap up the show. We want to say a couple of things about the passing of Arturo Vega, who of course was the spokesman, the t-shirt salesman, the t-shirt designer, the logo designer, the part-time lighting director, and really was as much a part of the Ramones as someone who's associated with the band but not in a band could possibly be. He passed away this past weekend in Manhattan at the age of 65. No cause of death announced yet. Not that that matters. We posted a brief obit on Punk News you can check out. There's actually a really great one on the New York Times if you haven't read that yet. And it really encapsulates kind of what Vega did for the Ramones and kind of what he meant to the band. Obviously, he was the designer of their iconic logo, which, you know, it's one of those things, whether you're into punk rock or not, you can pretty much instantly recognize when you see it. And, yeah, so I highly recommend you check out the New York Times obit. Let's see. I wanted to read an excerpt from this, but I got to find it now. Let's see. So here it is. This is from the New York Times. Quote, the t-shirts featured Mr. Vega's striking logo for the band, an eagle resembling the one on the presidential seal, except that one talon had an apple tree branch instead of an olive branch. The Ramones were as American as apple pie, Mr. Vega said. And the other held a baseball bat instead of arrows because Johnny Ramone, the lead guitarist, loved baseball. The band member's first name circled the symbol. I saw them as the ultimate all-American band, Mr. Vega, whose official title was artistic director, said in a 1993 interview. To me, they reflected the American character in general, an almost childish, innocent aggression. And that pretty much sums it up. Better than just about anybody else ever could.
Yeah. Better than my crappy obit, let me tell you.
that's yours actually what it said in the link. It was like, for a better obit than this crappy one. Can I just say, though, like really quick, like when I've read about him in his passing, is he's talked a lot about, like I read a lot about, you know, what inspired him. And, you know, first of all, like, it's crazy how much thought he put into that logo and how intentional everything is. And it really bums me out that nowadays every band seems to just be ripping off bands who actually had art designers. Like, everyone's ripping off Black Flag and ripping off Dead Kennedys, and they're ripping off the Ramones shirts. And they're like, oh, we put fucking 8 bars on the logo and it says Dick Salad instead of Black Flag. It's our t-shirt. And it's like, it fucking bums me out because these were people who, like, you remember the Ramones logo because of what it was. You remember the Black Flag logo because of what it was. Because people actually spent time and thought of these things. And they had people who, like, that's what they did. And so, I don't know. There are still bands who do that. There are still bands who put a lot of thought into the visual aspect of what they do. But, like, to have a band who had an artistic director and who, you know, that was what he did, you know, essentially. Like, I don't know. I think more bands need to kind of follow that lead where their art and their look is intentional. And they're not just, you know, oh, we'll put gothic font on the front and, you know, a bird with one wing. Or we'll just copy the Black Flag logo and fucking call it a day. Like, I don't know. It kind of made me think of how lazy some people have gotten in regards to that. Also, apparently he started doing a lot more of his own work and had started doing shows recently. And had just, you know, gotten more into that area. And so I think it's kind of sad that, like, right as he started to branch out more as an artist, you know, he ends up passing. But it said, everything I read about him said that he was really happy with his work as of late. So, I mean, that's a lot more than a lot of people are going to get out of their life. So I guess that's good. That's all.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to suck the air out of the room.
No, it's you said it nicely. So nicely that we can end the show on it, or at least go into our final song.
Damn. Right.
So we've got one more song, and then I guess I'll be back afterwards to wrap up the show. But for now, Adam.
I guess. So we'll see. We'll see Rich again in like episode 250 or something.
Episode 250, yes. Revenge of the Clones. Good night. Just like, people need to understand, I don't do anything with punk news anymore. Like, I'm happy to be on, but like, I'm not an editor. So people who are like, I keep getting emails about stuff, just, you can stop. Like, send it to people who can actually post your news. Like, I got tweeted at recently for a band, and it's weird, and I feel bad for them. Focus your attention on, like, Brian. He's good for those things. So, go ahead. Sorry.
All right. Rich has retreated into adulthood. And well, that's why, again, that we said, you sound like an actual grown adult man, so you're allowed.
I'm working on my distant and disapproving tone, so if I can get that down, I think we're good.
All right, this is our final song. It is, since we're talking about Toronto, this is from a band from Toronto. So we're actually streaming this whole EP right now, and you should listen to it because it's really good. This song I'm going to play is called The Shape of Punk That's Left. It's by Careers in Science. It is from the EP they just released on Stumble Records and Art Drug. I think that's CD/vinyl, that split, called Cowards. They played this thing in its entirety on the punk news stage at Scene Fest in St. Catharines this past weekend. And it was really, really good. And this
record is really good, and you should listen to it again, and we're streaming it. So this is Careers in Science, The Shape of Punk That's Left from Coward.
Going to do it for the Punk News Podcast this week. Hope you enjoyed our little mini reunion episode. Thanks to Rich and thanks to Adam, as always, for joining me on the roundtable. Thanks to Sugar Stems, Careers in Science, and ArnoCore for providing our songs on this week's show. Big, huge thanks to Nightbirds and Fat Records for providing our brand new theme song, Boat Trash. The song is from their new 7-inch on Fat, Maimed for the Masses. Highly recommend you pick that up. Excuse me. Don't forget to send us email. We do read them now. Podcast@punknews.org. If we get them, we might read them on the air, if you're lucky. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Last.fm, all those social networks. We'll be back next week. But until then, this has been the Punk News Podcast for the week of June 11th, 2013.